There are a few movies that you might identify by merely listening to the first bars of the theme music. For example, or but this time on 20 Minutes into the Future, John Lubkowski, Christopher Brown, and Alex Johnson discuss this one.
In this episode of Plutopia News Network podcast, we'll be discussing Stanley Kubrick's enigmatic masterpiece of film, 2001, A Space Odyssey. Joining us today are film director and writer Alex Johnson, director of Two Step, and science fiction author Chris Brown, author of Tropic of Kansas. 2001 is a brilliant, expansive film about the evolution of humankind from primitive apes to an idealized star child. The science fictional vision that is that evolution is supported by the intervention and guidance of unseen aliens, represented by featureless black obelisks that appear at the dawn of man and later in 2001 to guide us beyond the stars and back again. The film has a few narrative bursts and many longer meditative scenes. Critics have said the film is boring. The New Republic's review called it a film that is so dull, it even dulls our interest in the technical ingenuity for the sake of which Kubrick has allowed it to become dull. The film did find its audience, though, especially among younger people who were known to enforce altered states via various drug combinations before wandering into dark theaters with massive Cinerama screens to watch. And today, the film is a classic 50 years later, and this spring and summer has been the 50th anniversary of the film. Let's start with a question for Chris Brown. Chris, how does 2001 fit into the history and traditions of science fiction?
Well, it's a great question, John. I mean, I think it's sort of the paragon of certainly within science fiction cinema of the capacity of science fiction to convey the truly sublime, to achieve a kind of a tremendous and mind-blowing sense of wonder without having to engage in any kind of exposition. And in fact, by not engaging in exposition, by not doing any of the kinds of things that you associate with more conventional science fiction narrative, think of, you know, your kind of classic, Space Patrol kinds of stuff from the golden age of the so-called As You Know Bob, where one character will turn to the other and explain, you know, how they are able to travel faster than the speed of light, or what happened in the last 200 years before the characters got there. And so I think more than anything, it sort of sets that lodestar of achievement that, you find in some science fiction literature, but very rarely in film, and one that I don't know that it's really ever been matched.
Alex, can you say how 2001 has influenced filmmaking since it was made?
Wow. Okay. That's a big question. I think certainly it has. I mean, one clear way is kind of interesting in its enigmatic nature is kind of the ending, the kind of like ending with multiple interpretive meanings. You know, I think that there wasn't so much of that before. Kind of the embracing, challenging an audience into maybe not getting what you're shooting for on the first pass, or maybe ever. I think that that was certainly something that it started. I mean, in science fiction cinema, I keep thinking about, I'm trying to think about how much how much was there with technology before, with kind of like, especially at the time, the kind of like the fear of how technology could turn? I feel like that becomes a major, major factor in science fiction cinema. But in terms of just cinema in general, certainly embracing of silence to me, using, you know, the score, that was kind of totally an oddball move for most people. Most people thought it was totally strange to have kind of this scored using the classical music the way he did it. But I think that technologically, or just, you know, in terms of like how you tell a story, it's really, just to circle back around to what I was saying, the embracing of an enigma. You know, I don't think that was really so present in cinema beforehand, both in how you tell the narrative and how you quote unquote resolve it. That's really the biggest thing that I think for me.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. One of the things that I recently read this a book by Michael Benson about the making of 2001. And one thing that was clear was that they were sort of improvising. And when I say they, I mean primarily Stanley Kubrick and Arthur C. Clarke, who came together and agreed to co-author this story. And they had a pretty good general sense. They originally started writing it in book form because Kubrick liked to work from books. And then Kubrick set out to make the film and had a general sense of what he was going to do. But so much of what found its way to the screen sort of got there through serendipity and last minute decisions and that sort of thing. And kind of a question for you, Alex, I wonder how much that's like filmmaking traditionally happens. To what extent, I mean, as a filmmaker, when you're going into making a film, how well can you anticipate what you're going to have as a finished product? And to what extent is there a lot of sort of improvisational stuff that happens along the way?
Well, I'll speak for myself. I know that, you know, there are certainly people that it's not true, but, you know, I think you always have to be open to what's happening in the moment. When I, you know, in terms of making a film, there's obviously the screenplay, which is, you know, and I write my stuff as well, is a written version of what you're doing. You try to imagine for how things are going to sound, how they're going to work, how they're going to cut together. And then you get on set and things change on set and you change things there. And then you also have to be open to changing things in the edit, where you're taking things out of context. You're moving things around. You're using one thing for something else to help you get somewhere narratively. I mean, that's kind of how I came up doing things. I mean, on the flip side of that, there are people, you know, there are obviously people like the Coen brothers who, you know, when they submit give their actors their sides, they actually give them the storyboards that are literally show how they want their faces to be and where they're going to be framed and what the reaction is going to be. I mean, I have a friend who used to work as an associate editor for them, and she used to joke that the storyboards are essentially a flipbook of the film. Like, she could just put them up and they would be exactly what they shot, just a still version of it. But I think that, yeah, I mean, they're just things come out of nowhere. I think that Kubrick, for all of his praise as an auteur, was also somebody that, whatever, all the stuff I've read about him is that he always was looking for a good idea wherever it would come from. Didn't care about where it came from. He embraced listening to people on set and listening to other crew members in terms of like where things might go. So yeah, I mean, it's pretty organic for me. I don't know. I think before I made my first short film, I had that idea like that it was going to be exactly as I shot it. And you just start shooting for me. And I was like, okay, it's got to be organic. It's got to be in the moment. We've got to roll with what's happening in this moment. And we have to change things if it's going to get us to a better place. So that's certainly how I work, and a lot of people that I talk to work.
And I think, and John, I think, Alex, I think that's true of all storytelling, really, that, you know, having that opportunity, being open to the discovery of story in the course of telling the story is usually a secret of great art, whether it's, you know, writing a novel or writing a science fiction short story or doing a film. But it's rare that with something with a budget like that, that you have the latitude to do that kind of improvisation, I have to think. And maybe that's part of what's so remarkable about this.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I thought was most interesting was sort of in reading about the evolution of the story all along or most of the way through creating the story and working on the film, there was this thought that they should depict aliens. And they kept trying to figure out how the aliens should be depicted. And they tried various models and ideas and so forth. And at some point, Carl Sagan, who Kubrick really didn't like very much, but Carl Sagan was in conversation with them and said, well, you shouldn't show the aliens at all. You know, there's no way that you can do it and do it right. It's best to just suggest their presence rather than show them. And that is ultimately where Kubrick came down. It seemed he couldn't really find a better way to do it than to just sort of leave them out of the picture and just imply their existence. And that turns out to be a powerful part of the poetry of the film.
It gives it a kind of narrative negative space that works really well, that's sort of evocative and powerful. That makes a lot of sense. You think of how rare it is that there are portrayals of aliens in cinema that are plausible. I mean, the only one that I can think of is very recent, and it's Arrival, and that's partly because of the Ted Chiang story that was so strong.
Yeah, I was the film I started thinking about was Close Encounters of the Third Kind, and how the aliens are kind of cartoonish, really, in that. And it fits. I mean, kind of the way that Spielberg depicts aliens sort of fits where he's going with the film. But in 2001, you know, really there's this, you've got this obelisk, this big black, like, rectangular object. And that's all that you really get to suggest the aliens, and it's sort of like a black box, right?
Yeah, the monolith.
But then also the I mean, I don't know, you know, everything's open to interpretation at the end, right? But one of the most eerie aspects of the film for me are the kind of like whispery voices in the hallway during the whole sequence when Bowman arrives, when he passes through the obelisk and he's to the monolith, and he's, you know,
he's in the hotel room.
He's in the hotel room, yeah, the zoo or whatever interpretation you're going for. But I found that's so effective and so disturbing, the kind of like you just hear movement in the distance and whispers and you can't quite figure it out. I mean, just that alone is far more terrifying to me than just showing an alien.
It's true.
Yeah, I mean, that whole sequence of moving through the Stargate, obviously he's depicted as being sort of terrified, but you can just imagine how frightening that would be.
I mean, how you just saw it last night, right, John? How well does that segment hold up to a...
Oh, really? Very well.
Yeah.
It's still very powerful. Even though the screening last night was there were some technical issues with it. Oddly enough, at the point where Bowman is almost done disconnecting Hal, the film just stopped. It's like they had a break in the film or something, and it just stopped. And it took them like 5 or 6 minutes to get it back on again. I thought, wow, that was really perfect timing.
Was it a 70 millimeter projection or was it 35? Do you know?
They announced it. They advertised it as a 70 millimeter projection and as the sort of unrestored Chris Nolan print.
Yeah.
But the print didn't really look very good and was a bit out of focus. And we were disappointed.
70 millimeters is you know, it's tough sometimes, you know, to get a great high quality projection, and it's hard sometimes to get qualified folks to project it. But I'm in Austin, you should be able to do it. But
did either of you see the film in Cinerama?
I did. I was like 4 years old. I saw it in Cinerama. It was probably a year or two after it came out, and my dad took me, and I was like a little astronaut nerd, you know, like I want to grow up and be an astronaut. And I saw there was this theater in my hometown of Des Moines, which is like the opposite of an enigmatic sense of wonder being there. And so you go into that theater, this huge theater with that giant curved screen. And it's like rewriting the software of your brain. It's just the experience was really profound, I think. And I've seen it recently on, I think, 70 millimeter projections, certainly in the last decade. And it does hold up really well. Which makes it all the more remarkable. And in some senses, it seems kind of, I don't know, more profound in a way. And just the way he uses, like silence, as you were saying, Alex, and, you know, this sort of stillness or this kind of like, stasis and inertia. It's like he's like just like painting with slow gravity or something across the screen, and the way that he can take those long spans of time without dialogue, sometimes with or without music, and like completely hold your attention wrapped just watching these objects move through space. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, the Stargate effects at the end were particularly powerful on a Cinerama screen. I saw it in 68 in Cinerama. I mean, we set off on our own odyssey from Texas to, presumably we were going to go to like San Francisco and put flowers in our hair, but we actually stopped in Flagstaff where we had friends and never got past Flagstaff. But I managed to convince everybody that we should make the drive to Scottsdale where they had a Cinerama theater. The Kachina Theater, and we saw the film there, and we were really blown away. And on the drive back, we were driving back at night, and the stars were bright in the sky, you know, in the Arizona desert there. It was a fairly profound experience, you know, to have seen that thing then. And we just kept seeing it over and over again, and I knew a lot of people who were, but when the film first screened, it was like every filmmaker's nightmare. People just got up and left in droves, you know, and a lot of the critics really didn't like it, and they thought it was boring. And it was really younger people that sort of turned on to it. And I think John Lennon once said that he was going to see it every week at one point.
Yeah, I mean the way it just refuses to really tell story and require you to kind of just take in what's put on the screen, and the totally unresolved nature of the ending, as Alex was saying, I think that yeah, for some people, I'm sure that didn't work well at all, especially people who are accustomed to a much more overt kind of narrative mode. But it worked really well for a kid.
One thing I was just going to add to when you're talking about kind of like how it was received and kind of the pace of it and everything. You know, one thing that's amazing about it too is I think, you know, it actually does that whole kind of like opening after, you know, we leave, you know, the plains of Africa and we're up in space. That whole sequence with the space flight to me is almost like this transitional, this period of kind of like making your heart rate and adapt to the speed of the story a little bit. You know, it's kind of like forcing you to be patient and just being like, this is how it's going to move. This is how it's going to go. We're going to appreciate things as they move through the frame at their own pace. You know, the narrative is going to go at its own pace. It's sort of a transitional little phase that gets you into the film, which I like.
And he hadn't really done that before in any of his movies. Had I mean, Strangelove was what preceded this, right? Mm-hmm. And that's like a really almost like frenetic narrative. It seems like compared.
Yeah, Paths of Glory too.
Yeah, I mean, Path of Glory, that was the first Steadicam. I mean, talk about like frenetic. They didn't call it a Steadicam. They built something because of the movements they wanted to do through the foxholes. But yeah, it's pretty, I don't know. It's a phrase, you know, tossed around a lot, but it's pretty damn bold. I mean, the choices are just, there's such commitment to what he did and they're pretty extreme, especially for the time.
Mm-hmm. He was such a perfectionist. He really worked hard at getting everything exactly right. I think it's sort of interesting too, the depiction of a psychotic computer. It's sort of interesting for, I think that's one of the most intriguing story elements in 2001 is the fact that Hal is actually just a bit of a psycho.
Hello, Hal, do you read me? Do you read me, Hal?
Affirmative, Dave. I read you.
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
You know, he's had a bit of a break. And apparently, the way that I understand it, he's been given a command that conflicts with his basic operating system that he is forced to conceal the intent of the mission or what the true mission is, and that he's really not built to conceal. So that sets up a tension within him that ultimately leads him to see the humans as a threat to the mission.
What's the problem?
I think you know what the problem is just as well as I do.
What are you talking about, Hal?
This mission is too important for me to allow you to jeopardize it.
I don't know what you're talking about, Hal.
I know that you and Frank were planning to disconnect me. And I'm afraid that's something I cannot allow to happen.
Yeah, it's a brilliant thing. I mean, the idea of algorithmic logic without human judgment, and sort of a very early, you know, narrative parable on that, in a way that is probably, to the extent that the film is prescient, that's probably where it's most prescient in terms of these, you know, people in a pure technological environment imprisoned by their own algorithms.
And then there's the scene that really sort of amounts to lobotomizing Hal. Is, I think, one of the most powerful in the film. Can you recall, Chris, in your years of reading science fiction, anything quite like that?
No, I mean, science fiction tends to really valorize technology or take place after in a world after technology has failed or humanity's failed. But the idea of, you know, destroying the tool is so sort of contrary to the basic impulses of science fiction, which tends to be obsessed with the that kind of engineer's adoration of the tool. That I think it's pretty rare, and I don't know that any come to mind. I'll think about it. I mean, you have the, like, you know, there are the sort of fun, you know, Magnus robot fighters, sort of us versus the machines kinds of things, and those recur. I mean, I had some of that in Tropic of Kansas in a way, but nothing with that sort of sophistication. And yeah, you're right. I mean, the way that it humanizes the computer and suggests that there's some element of sentience and autonomous identity there, and that it's being, you know, dissected while it's still alive, it's pretty intense.
Yeah, it's very there's an emotional content, yeah, that you sort of wouldn't suspect would be there.
Yeah, I mean, it's really the epitomizing of the moment of what the create, you know, killing this this humanized, you know, version of you know, you, that you are killing it. You know, it just it's incredibly, it's really a sad, emotional scene. I love that scene so much.
Stop, Dave. I'm afraid. I'm afraid, Dave. I can feel it. My mind is going. There is no question about it. I can feel it. I can feel it. I can feel it. I'm afraid.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting that in the sequel in 2010, they bring Hal back, and there's this real tension about whether when they bring him back, he's going to be reasonable or not, or whether he, you know, he's going to be a problem.
With Hal 2.0 or something, right?
They think
they fixed the bugs.
Well, yeah, they actually took Chandra, who's the scientist that was
right,
most of the work in developing him, along with them, so that they could make that fix. And then in 2010, Hal at the end accepts death, you know. He clearly fears death, but he accepts it.
Is it voiced by the same actor?
Same guy, Douglas Rain, you know.
Okay.
And interestingly, originally that voice was going to be Martin Balsam. Can you imagine that?
That's kind of awesome. It's
like, it would have been so different if it was Martin Balsam.
I thought you were going to say Walter Matthau.
Actually, Walter Pigeon would have been good.
Yeah, he's Mr. Forbidden Planet, right? Morbius.
Yeah.
Balsam might have added a more, even more of a different type of intensity.
Yeah, sure, totally.
It would have been more overt, less creepy, just scary.
Yeah, and I was going to ask about sort of your thoughts about that. The way the characters are portrayed or the acting in the film, I mean, mainly it's two guys. It's like Keira DeLay and Gary Lockwood. But they're more machine-like than Hal is, really.
Yeah. Yes, totally. Yeah, I totally agree.
Go ahead. No. Yeah. Well, I was going to say they're like perfect. It's really cool the way they bridge back to like golden age and kind of post-World War II, immediate post-World War II science fiction stories, because they're like all-American mid-20th century military guys who are actually creations of like training by the state. And so they are very machine-like in that way. I think it's a really astute observation you make.
Yeah, they're completely dedicated to the mission.
Yeah, even in the back and forth in the pod, it's almost like a dragnet-like scene when they're discussing Hal, you know, in that moment that just like, fact? Yes, fact, fact, fact. And they just process and then they come to a conclusion pretty quickly.
But I will say I was impressed by Keira DeLay's performance, seeing it again last night. You feel a strong sense of the person behind all of that control, and he has to come out of it when he's in the scene where, he has to show very subtle emotion that starts to grow maybe a little more intense in the Stargate scene where he's like passing through the Stargate and eventually he's really, you know, he's really feeling some terror.
Mm-hmm.
And then he reaches the end of that thing, and he's again sort of like composed, completely composed in the hotel room thing. It was also interesting that in the Stargate sequence, several of the shots where you see delay are actually stills and not film.
I just can't stop imagining, talking about Dragnet now just has me thinking about the version where Jack Webb is the voice of Hal.
Jack Webb actually would have been pretty good as one of the astronauts, I think.
Or as Dr. Haywood Floyd, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Kind of walking the moon looking for hippies. The internet should be making all these alternate cuts with all these.
I was going to say, William Sylvester had a complete meltdown could not get through the scene. It was that scene where he was giving the talk on the moon base.
Right, the kind of briefing.
Yeah, and it turns out he couldn't get through that. And he started having just an incredible, like, anxiety attack. And if you watch the briefing, you'll see that it's cut several times. And it's because Kubrick really wanted to just stay back and shoot the whole thing in one long scene, yeah. Right? But he had to cut because Sylvester couldn't get through it. Well, I really appreciate you guys joining us to talk about 2001. And I've been really excited myself about the whole 50th anniversary thing. And I think it's great that people are getting out to see it. There was a packed theater last night, packed and enthusiastic.
I think it's really interesting on this 50th anniversary of this film to be thinking about it both as this sort of lasting and atemporal product that retains a lot of independent artistic value for all the reasons we've talked about, and also about some of the other contexts of the time of its making and the time that it came out. I independently just this year read another thing from 1968, which was Norman Mailer's Miami and the Seizure of Chicago, about like the two political conventions that were going on while this movie came out, and this very, like, to me, sort of eye-openingly dystopian view into a society that was on the verge of revolution, with, you know, back-to-back political assassinations and, you know, fascist mayors sending out the jackboots and war in every direction, and in a way that makes our current, you know, tumult seem sort of mild. And considering it from that context, it seems even more, I don't know, astonishing the transcendence that Kubrick was able to achieve. And it says a lot to me about the importance of art that can pull that kind of thing off, that can kind of step out of its particular historical moment to do something deeper and that spans, you know, literally eons. So it's pretty awesome.
It seems to me that in the Arthur C. Clarke's book, which he and Kubrick wrote it pretty much together, but it was really more Clarke than Kubrick, and it's more like literal and prosaic. And I seem to recall it at the very end of the film, when the Star Child is there sort of hovering above the earth, that there's atomic bombs going off below him.
That is absolutely what was kind of written into the, like, novella. And I don't think it's in the movie at all. And that's, again, it's why the movie is, like, superior to the story. I mean, the movie uses things that only movies can do to tell a science fiction story better than any science fiction writer could ever do with words on a page.
I'm fascinated by movies from the past about the future that are now in the past. And kind of like what that says about us and where we went. I love seeing it as an idea of kind of like this string of a possible future that didn't happen. I just find it fascinating. You know, but artistically, I'm struck by just how it is one of these movies that I can just watch again and again and again, and just be so drawn into it, even for lack of whatever you want to call it, traditional plot or traditional action. I remember first seeing it as a kid and loving everything from, you know, space on, you know, onward. I remember being perplexed by the opening, but it's just such a amazingly carved and crafted piece of art that, that there's always something worth seeing, worth experiencing. You know, it's, I don't think people watch films repeatedly enough. You know, it's like, you know, how many times do you listen to a record or read a book sometimes, but, you know, definitely revisit it and let it speak to you again and again.
Daisy, give me your answer to. I'm half crazy.